Well, I mean, you know, the history of the Dr. Rosen winery, I mean, it's a typical history of a typical old world, you know, family estate, which, you know, I mean, long-standing tradition. The estate is now 200 years, about 200 years in the family, you know. So it's 200 years and six generations. Because we have a tradition since 200 years to do Riesling in this area, you know. Mm-hmm. More or less since 200 years, we produce only Riesling, you know, so single varietal, white wine varietal Riesling. You know, old bourgeois wine estates, you know, as we call ourselves, have been more or less started here in the area 200 years ago by Napoleon. Because this area is very Catholic, you know, very, very, very Catholic area, so very, you know. And so before that, most of the vineyard holdings here, you know, you can say 70-80% of the vineyard used to belong to the church, you know, to clerical donations, to monasteries, to the bishop, or to the churches of the villages, you know. So a lot of clerical donations and this kind of stuff, you know. But then 200 years ago, 1804, Napoleon came, you know, conquered Germany, and, you know, I've been all the way going to Russia. And he basically confiscated all the church property, because in these days, 200 years ago, I mean, possibly the richest company in the world was the church, you know, possibly still, you know, possibly the Catholic Church is possibly still the richest company in the world. And so he confiscated all the church property, you know, that means the monasteries, the vineyards, all these clerical donations, you know. And sold it on auction, you know. And these auctions have been called secularization auctions, you know. And sold it then away. And that was the time 200 years ago that rich bourgeois people, you know, suddenly had the choice, you know, to buy, you know, whole estates, you know, a whole monastery with the whole vineyard site, you know. And that was the time when all the bourgeois wine estates started here in the Mosel, about 200 years ago, with Napoleon, you know?
Okay.
And so, and that's the same with us, you know? My great, 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 great uncle, you know? He was a solicitor, a notary, a Prussian notary under Napoleon, you know? And he had been leading these auctions, you know? And so from that point of view, you know, and so all these vineyards have been sold. I mean, it was a clever move from Napoleon, because he made a lot of money with it, and financed with this money, basically by confiscating church property, selling it away, and with this money he made on these auctions, he financed all his wars throughout Europe, you know. So, but on the other hand, we have to thank Napoleon, because all the bourgeois wine estates who are now existing, mainly started with Napoleon, because he sold all the church property on which bourgeois people had been able to buy land and vineyards and estates, you know, which used to be in the hands beforehand with the church, you know. So that is mainly the background of the history here, you know. So, roughly. The next question is, what makes the blue slate soil so special, you know? Well, the slate soil, or what we call the Devonian slate soil, because it's from Devonian time. Devonian time is 400 million years old, when this slate, this is what we call our blue slate, was created, you know, in Devonian time. What makes it so special? It is a soil, I mean, very stony soil, you know? It has a lot of potassium, natural potassium in the stones, you know. That means it is a kind of a natural source of potassium. You know, potassium is quite an important, really, mineral, you know, for growing, I mean, I mean, they really clawed in everything, farm for farming, no? Not only for wine, for wheat, for every corn, everything. Potassium was very important. And this high content, what Dennis Austin said, this high content of potassium, this mineral potassium in our soil, you know, gives this Riesling, this minerally-driven, you know, acidity, minerally-driven acidity, this lively acidity, you know? And the soils are, inside of that, it is very special because it, you know, the blue slate on the surface is only stones. It retains the heat, you know, during the day and gives a warm environment to the vineyard because we are northern growing climate, you know. Usually it's a much more colder, not this year, but but usually it's a colder climate, a cooler climate, what we call here. And so a warm soil is very important for growth, you know. And for the life of the microorganism in the soil, if you have a very alive soil of microorganisms, they break down all the organic material, you know, down to humus, you know, to nitrogen. So that means a full life of microorganisms in the soil is also very, it tells you that you have a healthy soil, a good soil. Lots of microorganisms, which turns, you know, organic material in humus, you know, which nitrogen is again very important for growing of not only vine and corn, I mean plants, you know. So then the other thing, this late soil, this stony soil gives a very good drainage, you know, to the soil, you know. And good drainage means the water can go through the soil easily, and it doesn't stay in the soil too wet, so the soil can warm up. That's again good for the microorganism, and for us very special, this extremely drained soil. You know, for us it's quite important because we are one of the very very few areas here in Europe, I think in this size, even the only area, which are still on uncrafted vines, you know, original rootstocks. So we still have a lot of vineyards which are still on the original rootstock, no American rootstock, on their original rootstocks, you know. So the oldest vineyards are 130 to 150 years old on their own roots because of the slate soil, because phylloxera can't live in the slate soil, you know. So from that point of view, this soil makes it very special. And the typical aroma structure for the Riesling coming from blue slate is what we call stone fruit aroma, no? Yeah. The blue slate gives this beautiful stone fruit aroma to our wines, you know, green apple, white peach, yellow peach, if it is riper, if it is apricot. Alpha Aufschneiden. And that gives this typical aroma structure for blue slate in our Riesling is what we call stone fruit aroma. All kind of stone fruit aroma, starting from apple to white peach to yellow peach, and if it is very ripe, all the way up to apricot, you know?
Yep.
And it's also very typical for the blue slate soil, you know?
Yep. We certainly get that in the wine that we made with you. A lot of stone fruit.
Exactly. That, you should have this. Definitely you should, experience it in your wine, you know?
Yeah.
The apple and peach, you know? That's very typical, you know, for the Riesling. From our area, from the slate soil, you know?
Yep.
That's very typical. What do you enjoy most about making wine, you know? You know what I always said? I mean, since 30 years I'm in the wine business, or 35 years now in the wine business, 37. A great wine, you know, starts in your head, you know? Because I think making a wine is very exciting as long you know what you want to produce, you know? If you have a clear idea, you know, of the wine you want to produce, you know? Because if you don't, I mean, I always said, if you never drank a great wine, you know, if you never experienced the great wines of the world, you know, how you want to make a great wine, you know? I mean, you need to have a certain idea what you're looking for. Sure, there is this idea, especially with the natural producers and the orange producers, I don't want to do anything, I don't want to touch anything, I leave it to God to make the wine, I leave it to the nature to make the wine, you know? But you know, my experience is, if you leave it to God and the nature, the only thing you're basically ending up with is vinegar, you know? nature is not a great winemaker, I tell you, you know? Because if you leave it to nature, but at the very end, you get vinegar and not wine, you know? I'm sorry, I don't like to drink vinegar. If you want to make a great wine, you have to interfere. And I don't understand this old philosophy always from these people. Oh, no, I don't want to interfere. Sure, less is more. We don't want to, use too much or to interfere the whole time. But you still, it is like, raising kids, you know? You have to give advice and you have to be sometimes, you know?
Yes.
Quick, you know?
Sure.
Otherwise, these just say dancing on your head, you know, and dancing on the table like the mouse, you know. And so, you know, so you have to, you know, and we all know they are. They need some. You have to discipline, you know. And making wine is the same, you know. You have to interfere sometimes, because if you don't interfere and don't do anything, it is exactly what I said. The final result is then vinegar, you know? It's volatile, it's vinegar. I'm sorry, this is not great wine, you know? And so, and from that point of view, to make a great wine, okay. And then it is first to have the idea, you know, what do I'm looking for? What do I want to do? Sure, everybody has different ideas, you know? Some people are going more in this direction, that, like keeping it longer on the barrel, keeping it, here you have a lot of tools and instruments, you know,
yep.
to go in different directions, you know.
Sure.
But at the end of the day, always some input to do, you know. Either you leave only a short time on the yeast, a long time on the yeast. But if you leave it long time on the yeast, you still have to watch it. You have to top the wine up. If you don't top, you can leave it on the yeast. But if you don't top up for 2 years, you know. Then you get oxidation. Nobody wants to have oxidation in the wine, you know?
Right.
If you top it up, that does not work. Top it up every month, then you keep it fresh, you know? If you don't do anything, you get oxidation, you know? So from that point of view, it is these little steps, you know, that you have to care about to watch during the winemaking certain steps. And if you want to avoid oxidation, top it up. If you want to do this, if you want to have a little more oak, okay, then put it in your oak barrel, you know? But if you want more micro-oxidation, put it in a bigger barrel, an older one, you know? You have enough tools, you know? And sure, less is more. You don't have to filter the wine every month, you know, or whatever, you know, or putting a lot of chemicals on it, you know? You can do without chemicals, but still, you have to care. You have to care about it, you know? And that is winemaking. Winemaking is, for me, rather to care about the barrel, you know? You have an idea of what you want to produce. And then step by step, caring about it. Surveying it, you know, tasting the wine every month to check on it, you know, is it still good? Is it going the right direction? Is it just the direction where you want to go, you know, or do you have to interfere a little bit and to correct it a little bit, you know, or whatever, you know? So from that point of view, that is what my enjoyment in winemaking. But winemaking is a procedure which I need first. A clear idea what I want to produce, you know, and then I start to do all these things which I think you need to do to end up with the wine I want to achieve, you know.
Ernie, do you change your vision each year for what you want to do depending on the conditions, or is your vision for what you want to do the same year after year?
No. I think especially to make a great wine, you need a lot of experience, you know?
Sure.
I think that is the whole, that is extremely important, you know? Because you can't do a great wine, I can't start and say, I will do a great wine tomorrow, you know? I have my ideas. And then you work on these ideas, you know? Every year you try to get bigger, you know? And, you know, I always compare it with an, you know, exponential curve, you know? 70%, you know, the exponential curve, 70% of winemaking, you know? Everybody can do it. That's pretty simple, you know?
Okay.
But then the last 30%, you know, of winemaking to get better, you know? It's exponential more work as the first 70%, you know? So that means 70% is pretty simple. You do everything right, you know? You clean the mask, you know? You do, these are the simple steps, you know, which are basics, you know? You have to do to make a nice wine, you know? That is 70%, you know? The next 20%, you know, so going from 70 to 90% to achieve even more, you know, better quality. This next 20% is possibly the same work as the first 70%, you know?
Yeah.
And then for the last 10%, it's getting more and more work to achieve. And I think the last percent, you know, I mean, going up to 99% is exponential more work and intention and little details, you know, you have to do. And a lot of people say, you know, what is it? I mean, you know, I achieved 70, 80%, you know, but people don't taste this little bit of 5% more, you know?
Right.
And then I have to invest so much effort and, I mean, you know, and work into it, you know? And most people don't see it. But if you have the goal to make a great wine, the best wine, you have to go for the last, you know, step, for the last, you know, mile, you know? And this mile, I know it's not, I mean, this mile, for a lot of people said, this is a verse. All the work for this last mile, you know, it's so much work. And 99% of the people would probably not even recognize it. But this is not, you don't do it for the customers. I do it for myself. And I want to achieve it. It is my goal to go there and to see, to get this. Possibly that's the reason that it never gets there isn't a 100 point wine, no? Because if there is a 100 point wine, you can't get better anymore.
Right.
But this is the whole thing. You need the passion to get better and better every year. And even if it's only this little step, you know? But you want to be better. And if you have a 100 point wine, that means you can't get better anymore. And that is then, and then you have no goal anymore. That is impossible, you know? You always can, I mean, trying to get better. But
sure.
That means you need a lot of experience too, you know?
Yeah.
So from that point of view, like, you know, my GG reserve wines, you know?
Yes.
That is something which I'm doing now since 15 years, you know?
Yeah.
So, and I got the impression that I'm just in the beginning. If I would have the chance to talk to my great-grandfather, who has a 50-year experience with this, you know?
Yes.
He could tell me so much more because, you know, for me, I said, I just started something and I'm looking for 20 years. As soon as I have 20 years of my GG reserve, then I can put them all on the table, taste them next to each other. And then, you know, I think then the fine-tuning starts. Because then I learned, oh, okay, in this vintage, the 2 years was absolutely perfect. In this vintage, the 2 years was probably a few months too long. And in this vintage, we should have been going longer, you know?
Yeah.
But this is only, I can only find this out if I look back, you know?
Yes.
If I have these wines on the tick.
Yeah.
And this vintage, and I say, oh, this is 15 years old now. That is already getting a little bit tired, but why is the 20 year so much fresher, you know? And then I can start and think about the fine tuning. In these kind of vintages, I have to do it a little bit differently, you know?
Yeah.
And in this kind of vintages, I have to adjust here, you know, this kind of fine tuning now, you know? And this I can start after 20 years, and then I need another 20 years, you know? I mean, to do all the fine tuning. I have 40 years on the table, and then I can taste them all. And then, you know, okay, I need to get 100 years old, you know, to finish this project.
It's not a bad goal.
Yeah, but, you know, but that's the goal, get 100 years to finish my ideas, you know?
Hey, Ernie.
That's the reason. You can't change it every year. No, you have to stay with this kind of tradition and try to get better and better and better every year. You know?
Hey, Ernie, what when you go back and taste your great grandfather's wine, which I'm sure you have. And you taste that wine and you compare it to the wines that you've made over the last three decades, are there things that stand out in your mind that would say that it was different then or it's different now? Or is it really, are the wines still the same over all that period of time?
Only the problem is I had only one bottle, you know? Because sadly we don't have the wines anymore.
Oh.
Because we had been here occupied zone by the French, and the French confiscated all the wine.
Oh, I forgot about that. Yeah, yeah.
My grandfather was the 47, you know, he was allowed to produce and to keep. And so I had the 47, you know, GG Reserve, Oettinger Wirtsgarten.
Right.
And that was when it was 60 years old, the wine, you know. And so, and that was so fascinating. That is the reason this one bottle, I mean, turned my whole perspective about dry wine from the Moselle. That is this bottle, I mean, gave me the, I mean, barely, that was the initiative for me to change the whole winemaking for my dry wines again, you know?
Wow.
Before that, we had enough. But then I had this bottle, and I thought, holy moly, you know? Fuck what this old man did. He made dry wines, which I still can drink after 60 years, enjoy it. Sure, it's a matured wine, but not a fresh wine anymore. But it was perfectly matured. It was not oxidized. It was not pre-matured oxidation like a lot of the Burgundies now have, you know?
Burgundies, you know? Sure, sure.
It was a perfectly good wine. It was so enjoyable. It was delicious. It was great. And that, you know, and that gave me, and I had been going the next day to my winemaker and said, Bernie, we have to make wine as my great-grandfather again. I want to drink in 50 years of wine, you know, like this wine I tasted, you know? A wine, a dry Riesling, which you can drink after 40, 50 years still and enjoy it. And you are absolutely, I mean, fascinated. And this, we were working on this, you know? I mean, I'm not sure where we are because I have only 15 years ago when we started it. So I don't have yet these kind of things, but we are working to achieve, that is our goal, to achieve, you know, this kind of model, which I have in my head, you know, and here it comes again. I have this model in my head. I have this kind of idea of a great dry wine as my grandfather made it, because I had only once in my life an old bottle of this wine. And that gave me the whole motivation, you know, to go for that and to, I mean, to hopefully to succeed, you know. But this, I can't say now. We have to wait another 20, 25 years, and then we will see, you know? But we are still adjusting we see, when we learn in the last 15 years, we learned a lot, you know? We see that, I mean, the fine-tuning, you know? We see here and there, you have to, you know, to do a little bit of fine-tuning. Barrel management is also something, it's so... Barrel management for such a long time is also a very complicated thing, you know. We learn more about barrels, big barrels, because we do not the reefs, you know. We do only everything only in big barrels, you know. And so, from that point of view, so we have been just discussing this yesterday with the winemaker about barrels, you know, and we saw the different sizes of the barrel. I mean, 1,000 liters, 2,000, 3,000 liters. Makes a huge difference, especially for certain vineyards, for certain whiteness of the grapes, you know, acidity. What should I tell you? You know, it's complex. It's very complex, you know?
Yeah, yeah, I know.
And you learn, every year you learn a little bit more, you know? And you still try to improve every year, you know? And that is, and if you leave, I mean, if you lose, to the ambition and the passion, not getting better every year, you know?
Yeah.
Then it's over. I say then you lost also the passion for winemaking, you know?
Maybe that leads to, we'll skip by question four and come back to it, but question five talks about the fact that, and we experienced some of this when we were with you, that not only are these wines great now, You can drink them like this 2020 that we're drinking is fantastic, but we also know that it's going to age for a long, long time. And a lot of wines can't do that, right? Like you mentioned, Burgundies, they tend to oxidize over time or whatever. What makes Riesling special in that way?
Well, I think also this is what makes wine ageable, you know? In general, you can, it's very simple, you know? It's the low pH, you know? The lower the pH, the better the wine can age, you know?
Okay.
And that is very important. The pH is quite important. So from that point of view, I just recently had a 1978 Bordeaux, you know, 1978 Bordeaux.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, fresh, I mean, totally young still, you know? And, you know, and I had been looking on the label and said, holy moly, look at this. Bordeaux, 1978, and that was a good vintage in Bordeaux. Mm-hmm. That was supposed to be a great vintage. 11.5 alcohol. Cabernet, you know, Meritage, Cabernet Merlot.
Yeah.
Cabernet Petit Verdot. 11.5 alcohol.
Wow.
But 0.5 means also low pH.
Yeah.
I'm sure the first 20, you couldn't drink this wine, you know? It was very difficult to drink it, you know? It was probably hard, harsh by tenants and so. But now, you know, 78, what you're talking about? We're talking about 45 years old now, 44 years old.
Yeah.
I mean, that was beautiful, you know? Isn't it amazing?
Yeah,
you know? It is. And in old days, Bordeaux, one of the reasons that Bordeaux could age that well in the old days was it was not that high in alcohol. The pH had been much lower, you know? Nowadays, you know, we all know the alcohol levels are now also around 14.5 in Bordeaux. You know, pH is much higher than it used to be, say, 30, 40, 60 years ago. And so that changed. And that is the reason why Riesling can age so well. Riesling has a fairly high acidity, you know, total acidity in the finished wine because we're not going malolactic fermentation. And therefore, with this high total acidity in the wine, you always have a low pH, you know. Our pHs are around between 0.95 and 3.1, 3.15, so which is a fairly low pH, you know. And this very low pH, due to the acidity, the high acidity, total acidity, gives these wines great ageability, you know. But the ageability also comes not only from the pH. There's also certain winemaking which gives wines ageability, you know. Definitely, you know. This is, for example, one of the reasons of, I mean, a new oak. I mean, I know it is very, as a young wine, it's very prominent, you know, obvious. But, you know, in the old days, you know, in Bordeaux or Burgundy, they put it in new oak because they had to, because they sold, you know, the wine in the barrel. So they had to buy new oak for the new vintage, you know, because everything was sold in bulk, in the barrel. So, I mean, the new harvest had to go into new barrels. But, you know, tannin is nothing else as an acidity. So basically the new oak added tannin, which is an acidity, to the wine. And that gave them ageability again, you know, because the acidity, sure, lowered by the malolactic fermentation, plus the tannin as an acidity, a different time, by the oak acidity, you know, but the acidity from the oak, gave the wine more ageability. And therefore, that the wines have been anyway in the old days drank old, they never drank a Bordeaux or Burgundy when it was not minimum 20, 25 years old, you know. The new oak was gone, but it preserved the wine, you know.
Interesting. Thank you for that.
We can't produce wines anymore, but you can drink, or when you can start drinking in 20 years. But that was pretty common 50, 60, 70 years ago, you know, when people still, you know, aged the wines in their cellars or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
But that is definitely the low pH, you know, the acidity of the Riesling gives the ageability to the wine, you know.
So there's a last couple. I know I've kept you a long time, so I really appreciate what you're doing. The last ones are kind of two fun questions. We know you've got a great project going in Oregon, and if you'd like to talk a little bit about that, so our readers will know about it. But also, do you have any other plans for some new things you want to do?
Yeah, well, we I started, when was it, I started my first little joint venture project, you know, with Chateau Saint-Michel, where we produce a Riesling together, which is called Heroica. And so, because, you know, Washington State is possibly the largest Riesling producer in the U.S., you know, Washington State has a reputation for Riesling. And so we started this little Riesling project together with Chateau Saint-Michel in 99. And then in 2005, I started my little, because I always loved Pinot Noir, you know, I love Pinot Noir from Burgundy, but, you know, if you look to these prices, you know, it was definitely, definitely more affordable to do something in Oregon than in Burgundy. And I love Oregon, and I love the Oregon Pinot Noirs, supposed to be also, in these days, more a cooler climate area. And so we started 2005 this Oregon project, Pinot Noir project, you know, and bought some land in 2009, a 40-acre plot. Have been then planting vineyards there, have been building a nice winery in the old world style, underground cellars, you know, no air conditioning, isolated, you know, walls, you know, that we don't need air conditioning and natural climate down in the cellars, arched cellars down in the soil. And here we do Pinot Noir, 90% of Pinot Noir. We do one barrel of Riesling. We have the oldest Riesling vineyard of Oregon, planted 1976. It's one barrel, also made in this kind of GG reserve style. It stays 2 years in the barrel, on the full yeast, this Riesling. It's called Appassionata Riesling. We do a little bit of Sauvignon Blanc and sure, Chardonnay, you know, which works very well, for my opinion, in Oregon. And then about 90% is Pinot Noir. And it's a really fascinating project. It is also organically grown there. There we do organic growing, you know. Here we also go a little bit the old world direction. We just introduced a new line, which we call Appassionata line. That is our top wines, you know. And they get released with age. So the top Appassionata Pinot Noir, we call them after the, after music pieces, you know, allegro, andante, you know, and so the top wine, Appassionata top wine, is released after 10 years, you know, being bottled. So we just released the 2012, you know, the middle tier Appassionata is released after 5 years, you know. And then the other one is released after 3 years, you know. So 3, 5, and 10 years, we age it in our cellar, you know. So that's the reason we can do it only now, because, you know, I started, planting. And so 2012 is released now, this year. And the 10 years old, 5 years old, and 3 years old, the Pinot Noir, you know.
Yeah.
The Chardonnay, we produce the Chardonnay in the style as Chardonnay was produced in Puligny, in Burgundy 100 years ago, because they didn't do batonnage in these days, you know. They produced it in bigger barrels and left it on the full yeast, but without batonnage, you know, much more reductive, you know, than also Chardonnay could age, you know. So Chardonnay is produced exactly in the style as they did Chardonnay 100 years ago in Burgundy, very much the same way as I make my Riesling, as my grandfather made the Riesling. Very similar. No Burgundy producer told me, look, you know, Ernst, my grandfather produced the Chardonnay exactly the same way as you do your GG Reserve with Riesling. That was the same kind of winemaking we had in these days. Bigger barrels, no barriques, you know. And so, quite interesting, you know. So, that's an interesting project, you know, and yeah, I love it, you know. It is really interesting because we are probably the only one who released really old, you know, that we mature the wine, not only in the barrel, also in the bottle, and then release it to the customer. And the 2005 was the first Appassionata high-end Appassionata we produced, and this is not released. This, the 2005 I will release on my 25th anniversary.
Ah, excellent.
Yes. That is my first wine, so that means that will be in 2013, so we have to wait another 8 years.
Okay.
And then I have a little reasoning project I do with Jim Barry from in Australia. He's a very famous reasoning producer. We do also reasoning together, which is called Walter. But the same idea. I always thought, I mean, this old idea of reasoning winemaking is about 120 years ago. That is what the work in Australia, you know? Does it work in Washington State, you know? Does it work in Oregon? And so we have all over, we have this kind of idea to make this kind of a GG reserve style also outside of Germany and see how the wine does with this kind of old, you know, historic winemaking. How does it work with an Australian region? How does it work with a Washington State region? How does it work with an Oregon region? You know? How does it work with a motor reasoning, as I did it, you know, because that was my great grandfather, Mr. Motor. So this is quite an amazing, interesting project. And a similar project I have together with Telmo Rodriguez. Telmo Rodriguez is one of the most famous winemakers in Spain, where we do a wine together. I do a Rioja with my ideas in Rioja, and Telmo is doing a Riesling. He was always a big Riesling fan, so Telmo Rodriguez. Raymond Lure is the state in Rioja, and Lanzaga, and he makes a wine with his idea, with the idea of, you know, white wine making of Spain. He does a Riesling with me here in Germany. Interesting little project, you know. So this is more for fun and to learn, you know, because you learn always. With these kind of things, you learn so many things, you know.
Yeah.
And how does things fit and how things work. And all this learning procedure, you still can integrate into all your knowledge and what you want to achieve also for your own mind. There's always little things you can use also for here to make, and there's always, you learn always something which we try, and sometimes you find out, oh, that works also with us, you know, and can make, oh, here we improve again a little bit, you know. Sometimes it doesn't, you know, improve, you know, then it is irrelevant. But if you don't try it, you will never find out. Learning by doing is still a big thing for us. No.
You never stop learning no matter what you're doing. I love that.
Never stop trying to get better.
That's right. Okay, last question, a fun question. I remember Sharon and I loved the soup you made that time with the Riesling when we were there. Are you doing anything else with your wine other than soup?
Yes, we started to do 2 years, 2 years ago now, just with the pandemic when it started. We're doing a vermouth, you know?
Ah.
A vermouth, and it's quite an interesting idea. You know, vermouth is a wine, is an herbal wine, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because you use a lot of herbs to aromatize a wine, a vermouth. But usually, vermouth is a cheap product, you know? Vermouth, I mean, Cinzano, Martini, you know?
Yeah.
You take the cheapest wine, you know? You add, and then you do the extraction of all these herbs, you know? You do it in pure alcohol, you know? And then you use this different little alcohol, the many alcohols with the extraction of the different herbs you use, and then you make a blend and add it to the wine, and then you sugar it up with cane sugar or with beet sugar, you know? So it's a usually cheap process. But we said, look, we have a vineyard which is called Spice Garden, you know?
Yes.
Herb Garden and the Wirt Garden, you know, the Wirt Garden vineyard, you know? The Spice Garden, Herb Garden vineyard, you know?
Yeah.
So why we are not taking a wine, because vermouth is an herb wine, And why we're not taking a wine, we produce a Riesling in our Herb Garden and the Wirt Garden and the Spice Garden, as a Cabernet or Spät is 100% Riesling, because usually vermouth is never a single varietal. It is the cheapest crap which they, you know, buy, you know, very cheap. And so we do a high-end vermouth by have a single vineyard Riesling from the Herb Garden, you know, vineyard. That is a traditional kind of Cabernet Spät with a natural sweetness of the grape juice, you know, by stop fermentation. So we don't add any sugar to it. And the herbs for this project, the herbs for this wine, we grow in the vineyard, you know? So the herbs which we use to extract, to make the vermouth, you know, out of this wine, all the herbs, you know, at least 80-90% of the herbs, are also grown in the vineyard, you know? So we grow the vineyard in the vineyard, the herbs which we use for the vermouth, you know? It is the wine is from the Riesling Erzinger Rosgarten vineyard, you know? With the natural sweetness from the grape juice, you know? And then we mature this vermouth 1 year in a big old Mosel Fuder barrel, you know? So it's a really interesting. We got a lot of high ratings now with, you know, the drinks magazines, you know, and, you know, these kind of, you know, magazines which are going more for liquors and these kind of stuff.
Sure.
It's really interesting. Really nice little, very little project, you know, because of a lot of work.
What do you give the vermouth a special name?
We call it Würzgarten, you know.
Oh, Würzgarten. Okay, yeah.
Dr. Rosen's Spice Garden Vermouth, you know?
We'll have to look for it. Is it in the United States?
We have a list. All the herbs which are in this vermouth are on the label, you know?
Yeah. Did you export it to the United States?
Not yet, because the problem is as soon you export alcohol, you know, because which is under, you know, under duty in Texas, you know?
Right.
It makes it so. You know, I mean, we tried it, you know, but we didn't find a solution yet, you know.
Okay.
To get through the legal system, you know, that is the problem.
Yeah, it's always the problem.
but you know, next time when you come, I give you a bottle. You can flip it over.
Oh, thank you. We will be coming next year. We're going to bring Sharon's dad, whose family is from the area. We're going to bring him with us too.
Okay, yeah. I think it's in May when you guys come, huh?
Yeah, yes. Mm-hmm. Well, Ernie, is there anything else you'd like to add? That was incredible. I've got a lot of notes. I've got a lot of recordings. We have plenty. Did I miss anything you want to say?
It was so great to meet you guys last year, the first time, you know. Well, I think we had a wonderful time. And I think it is the great thing, you know. And you see, if you meet passionate winemakers, you know,
yeah,
that is always, you know, it's always great. People love each other, you know. They love to talk about wine. And so there's a mealy friendship, you know. There's a mealy friendship, you know.
I agree.
Would be a wine lover in the world, you know, a wine freak, you know, there would be no wars anymore, you know. So wine lovers, wine freaks, they want to drink, they want to enjoy their life, they want to eat and drink and talk, you know, and, you know, and if they're drunk, they fall asleep.
That's right.
They always get depressed.